Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Gosh, I don't want to suffocate all of you, but could we close the door?
Yeah, no, it's totally fine with that.
All right.
I'm Gracia Bridges, and I am 20 years old.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Stobie. I'm 19 years old.
And my name's Jordan Stobie, same last name. I'm 21.
We're currently in the back of our van, Maypril.
Gracia, Jordan, and Rebecca, they're the founding members of the folk indie rock band Charlie and the Rays, and they've put college on hold for now. Their jobs at restaurants pay the bills, and the time and energy that's left, it all goes to the band. And we're inside Maypril, the van, because it's the quietest spot we could talk. We're behind the Tractor Tavern in Ballard, because this is the night they're launching their first EP. It's called Black Licorice. I'm Jennifer Wing, and you're listening to Sound Effect. And today, we're revisiting some of our favorite music stories from the last year. And for these three young women, their dream of playing music together started when they were in high school.
Gracia and I were kind of trying to find something to do and decided to start busking at Pike Place. And then from there, it grew. I remember Gracia actually got like a How to Start a Band book, and we were like reading it, trying to figure out how to start a band. And so we decided to get a drummer and just went from there.
And is there a larger dream than quitting your jobs?
Yeah.
And
yeah, there's a larger dream.
What is your ultimate dream?
Well, just like, I would love to go on tour, like a world tour. That would be like, I think if we go on world tour, that would be like, we made it, guys, like we did it.
Basically being a rock star and just being able to express myself through music, and that being my passion my whole life, and people following us as a band and liking what we create.
I would love to just be in a place where I show up to a gig and my guitar is already set up for me. That is my dream.
Well, should we hear some music?
I've been wishing every day that you'll say you're mine. Hoping every day that you're fine, we're fine. So come over, little darling, say you're mine. So come over, little darling, say we're fine. I've been wishing every day that you'll say you're mine. Hoping every day that you're fine, we're fine. So come over, little darling, say you're mine. Come over, little darling, and say we're fine.
There we go.
That was awesome.
To kick off our look back at some of our favorite music stories from this past year, we're going to spend some time with a musical pioneer and entrepreneur, Bonnie Buckingham. She's better known as Bonnie Guitar, and had her first big hit in 1957. And the year after that, she did something very unusual for that time. She founded a record label in Seattle. She went on to produce bands that became Northwest music legends, and she kept on writing her own tunes, and she flirted with more fame over the decades. Today, Bonnie Guitar is 93 years old, and she's still playing. She does a weekly gig at a club in Soap Lake, Washington, where she lives.
Hello. Hi.
Bonnie Guitar may not get around as easily as she once did, but her eyes are bright. Her singing voice is intact, and her passion for music still bubbles just under the surface. Sound Effects' Gabriel Spitzer paid her a visit at her home in Soap Lake to talk about her many accomplishments and what it's like to grow old doing something that you love.
Could you tell me about when you first picked up the guitar?
I was about 12 years old, but my brothers, I had older brothers, and they both played guitar, so I could not play it. Finally, they allowed me to tune it, and once I could tune it better than they could, nobody got it away from me.
Was there a time when you were a child when you first knew that you weren't just good at playing guitar, but that this could be your life?
I knew that when I was about 12 or maybe less than 12. I lived on a farm. We had a lot of trees, and I used to climb trees and pretend I was broadcasting, and I had my eye on the business from the time I was old enough to think about it. At school, they wouldn't let me play guitar because they said it was a hillbilly instrument, and it was absolutely ignored. they didn't consider it to be an instrument that should be played in a band.
Away up high up in the sky, oh tell me why, oh tell me why you've lost your splendor.
So not having a lot of female role models, how did it even occur to you that this was something that you could do?
You know, I think, you know, I never thought of it. I just assumed that I knew how to do it, and I was learning more all the time, so I didn't question it.
Did you have to prove yourself to a lot of people?
Oh, my. Many. Every day, really. I remember the time a lady came to my place and asked me to do some demo records for her. And I said to her, who's going to hear this? And she said, well, I have a record label in Malibu, California, and they're waiting to hear my songs. Well, that was opening a door for me. So I did all the songs that she gave me. She sent them to Hollywood, and when he heard them, and he asked me to come to Malibu and audition for his studio. So my mom and I went down to Malibu, and I played guitar and sang for him. He immediately signed me with a record contract and made me a studio musician.
That was an important period for you, right, being a studio musician, because it got you an inside glimpse of what the studio system was like.
Oh, those were such good times, those years that I played in the studio. I got to be exposed to the kind of music I wanted to hear.
I'm living in two worlds, dividing my time.
How did you get the idea to start your own music label, your own studio?
I was associated with a fellow named Bob Reisdorf at the time, and he was a record promoter. We used to talk this business all the time, talk the business, and he was in Olympia, and he talked with the Fleetwoods, and they said, do you know Bonnie Guitar? And he said, yes, and they said, well, will you give her this tape so that she can listen to us? And I immediately knew that those kids could have a hit record. That turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me.
So how did you even go about setting up Dolphin Records? I guess it was Dolphin Records first, right? And you and Bob Reinsdorf launched that label together in Seattle.
I had spent so much time in Hollywood with Faber Robinson in his label at Malibu. I had been learning then because he was teaching me when he had artists come in the studio, instead of me playing guitar, he had me as his assistant. So while I'm in there being assistant, I'm learning everything I'm supposed to do. I'm learning the equipment. I realized that I could do that.
So I'd like to ask you about another band that you brought in after the Fleetwoods and their big success. You discovered another band, an instrumental band out of Tacoma, The Ventures, who are still one of the most famous bands in the Northwest.
They are. They came to our label, and that was something that was wonderful for us to follow up the Fleetwoods with someone like The Ventures, you know.
What do you like about recognizing talent, about finding undiscovered talent?
That's the most fun of all. Right now I'm working with a young fellow here in the Soap Lake area. He lives two blocks down. Magnificent talent that you'd never hear. He writes his own material. He's a singer. When I hear that, it's like eating a good steak. It just, I can't wait till I can get my hands on somebody to work with like that, you know. How could you not want to do something for that artist?
So I know you said you savor the quiet life that you have now and that you don't really need the glitz anymore. But as you kind of think back on the days of your fame, I mean, you tasted some real fame on national TV and on the Opry and on all these different places. What's a memory that you have that makes you smile?
All of those things were great. I did the Sullivan Show and the Dick Clark Show, and all those shows were great. I want to tell you this without reservation. This is the truth, if I've ever spoken it. I had some negative things, too, of course, but I had the most wonderful life in this business anyone could ever have, and that, if I think about that, that's a smiling thing. And now, the way life is now is wonderful, too, because although I'm not getting around very well, I still get to play on Saturday nights, and when you think about it, it can't be anything but a smile, I guess.
When you look at something like hearing tape of yourself from 50 years ago and stuff like that, do you still feel like the same person? Do you still feel connected to the young Bonnie Guitar who was out there making hits?
I do, in a way. I wish that I were more connected with the voice I had then, because as years go by, you lose your voice. So I tell you the truth, I get a little bit upset when I hear how I did them in those days, and I can't do them that way in those days because my range is too limited now. Pack up all my cares and woes, here I go, singing low. Bye, bye, Blackbird.
How have you managed to keep the dexterity in your fingers and your hands to play?
Well, I did, but just recently, somehow I just woke up one morning and my hand was swollen. Well, I haven't been able to play the guitar since that. So now in the band, I just sing, and I can't play the things like Mr. Fire Eyes and Riders in the Sky and those up-tempo things. So I'm being limited right now, and I probably have another 2 months before I'll be able to play at all.
Have you gone this long without playing guitar before?
Never, never, never. I couldn't. I have a guitar right by my side all the time right now, and I've had a guitar with me when I was in a hospital once. You get as close to that guitar as you do a person, almost. What we feel as musicians, that our instruments have soul, that they have a life of their own. And believe me, guitars are more so than anyone. And if I couldn't play it, I'd take it with me anyway.
Are you sad about not being able to play right now?
I am. I have that. I'd like to tell you no, but I tell you the truth. I hear things and I want to play that. And I want to play that so badly. And that makes me sad. However, I feel very happy about the fact that I have a future where I can look ahead and think that maybe in a couple months or 3 months I'll be able to play.
Well, Bonnie Guitar, resident of Soap Lake and longtime pioneer in music and production business and pretty much the whole spectrum, thank you so much for talking with me.
Gabriel, it's been wonderful talking with you. Thank you so much.
Welcome back to Sound Effect on KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today we're revisiting some of our favorite stories from the last year that involve music. And back in May, when the future of this radio station wasn't very clear, Sound Effect hosted a live event at Town Hall here in Seattle. And we were joined by some very special friends, including singer-songwriter Kimia Dawson. Kimia talked about her deep connection to her fans and how hard it is for her to set boundaries. She's always wanting to help others. Kimia is well aware of the emotions of the people around her, and this comes through in her music. That night at Town Hall, Kimia closed out her time on the stage by singing a heartbreaking original song about a little baby named Daniel.
This is a song about something that happened when I was little, and I realized, I was just on tour in Europe for 3 weeks, and I realized on that tour that the year that this incident happened was the year that Purple Rain came out. And sometimes when I get long emails from people where I'm like, oh, this is really heavy, then I always say to myself, this is the Sting letter, because when I was in high school, I wrote a really long letter to Sting. But I didn't send it. But I always have to remember where I was at, you know, where I was just like, imagine, now I imagine Sting being like, wow, she really loved that cat, you know? And this is a little bit about how Elton John helped too. And I think about all the ways that, like, Sting and Elton John and, like, Phil Collins and, like, all the soft rock that I was really into, like, how all those people had such a big effect on me, even though I didn't have direct access to them all the time. And then I like to think maybe on the days that I can't respond to people that maybe I'm still helping somehow. I was 12 and things had been pretty okay up till then. The only deaths I'd experienced were of pets and the grandparents of my friends. I was aimed gifted and talented till right around the 7th grade. But that is when everything changed and I had to flip a switch and shut off my brain. 'Cause if I thought too much, I'd get sick to my stomach. And I would feel like giving up or throwing up. It was just too tough. 'Cause that is when I realized that even little babies cry. I just tried to erase what happened. That is when I realized that even little babies die, and I had to build a wall inside to keep me from losing my mind. He was only 9 months old, a kid I'd babysit and hug and hold, and I would tickle his toes and pat his head and watch his chest rise and fall as he slept in his crib. And then my dad said late last night, a truck driver hit their car, he didn't survive. And his mom was hurt bad, but his dad is all right. His big brother is fine, 'cause he stayed at the party. Yeah, yeah, Steven is fine, 'cause he stayed at the party. And if I thought too much, I'd get sick to my stomach. And I would feel like giving up or throwing up. It was just too tough. Sometimes things happen when we are small that we just don't have the tools to deal with at all. So we bottle it up and we just don't see how the stuff that we stuff will affect who we'll be. What protects us as kids slowly makes us insane. So I'm trying to dismantle barricades brick by brick in an attempt to set free my brain. Brick by brick in an attempt to set free my brain. And I just hope that my heart is stronger now, so much stronger than it was when I was 12. When if I thought too much, I'd get sick to my stomach. And I would feel like giving up or throwing up. It was just too tough. And I'd sing Daniel again and again and pretend you were just traveling on a plane. Quarter century later, it's still hard to take, but with every red tail light, I scream out your name.
Yeah, with every red taillight, I scream out your name. Yeah, with every red taillight, I scream out your name. I say, Daniel, Daniel, Daniel. I say, Daniel, Daniel, Daniel. I say, Daniel, Daniel, Daniel. Baby boy, baby boy, baby boy. Baby boy, baby boy, baby boy. Baby boy, baby boy, baby boy, baby boy.
That was Kimia Dawson singing at the Sound Effect live event, A Friend in Need, back in May.
Took the Polaroid down in my room. I'm pretty sure you have a new girlfriend. It's not as if...
This is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today we're taking some time to revisit stories from the past year that involve music in some way. And just like sports, music has rivalries. West Coast hip-hop versus East Coast, the Rolling Stones or the Beatles, which side are you on? Here in the Northwest, it's Nirvana versus Pearl Jam. But how did this particular so-called rivalry even start? And did it ever really exist? Sound Effect's Gabriel Spitzer sat down with local music writer Charles R. Cross, who's written, among other things, the book Heavier Than Heaven, the biography of Kurt Cobain, my favorite, by the way, to help us clear all this up.
All right, so we're going to set the scene a little bit. So it's the early 90s, and Seattle music is white hot. It's a big commercial success. You got all these bands that were previously very obscure that now are suddenly thrust into the limelight. How did everybody get along? I mean, was it a tight-knit scene? Did everyone know each other?
Well, everyone got along great. You know, there wasn't this sense of, if you like us, you can't like them. That was not what the Seattle scene was about. I mean, we're recording this from Belltown. Soundgarden played their very first show that I saw them about four blocks away from where we were. There were 20 people there. Those people didn't say, I'm not going to Mudhoney tomorrow because I went to Soundgarden tonight. In fact, at that Soundgarden show, of the 20 people there, 10 of them were musicians and other bands. So Seattle was and remains a very tight-knit musician community where people are very supportive of other bands.
And as the kind of hype machine revved up, you had these two bands that rose head and shoulders probably above the rest of the crowd. Nirvana.
I'm so happy. Cause today found my friends in my head.
And Pearl Jam.
Freezing, rest his head on a pillow made of concrete. Yeah. Oh,
what was the narrative? What was the kind of gossip around the way those bands thought about each other?
The gossip was that Nirvana hated Pearl Jam and Pearl Jam wanted Nirvana's attention. That's essentially the gossip or way that it played out in the press. That wasn't true, but this is almost exclusively and absolutely entirely based on a handful of things Kurt Cobain said in offhanded interviews with radio stations. Now, Kurt was a very cranky interviewer at this point. He was addicted to drugs. He wanted to talk about anything other than his drug addiction. He hated being famous to some degree, and he didn't want to talk about that. So what's a great thing to talk about? Pearl Jam.
What's up with you
and
Eddie?
We never had a fight, ever. I just have always hated their band.
It's not like you're friends.
Let's deflect the attention on how big you are and cite the other band that's coming up out of Seattle. And so at the time, Kurt's quote on Pearl Jam is this. Pearl Jam was, quote, pioneering a corporate alternative and cock rock fusion, end quote. He also used the term in another interview in that time that Pearl Jam were careerists. Now, in the world of punk rock, this is the ultimate slam down insult. Essentially, what you're saying is Pearl Jam is in it for the money. Now, Kurt is saying this while he's on the cover of Rolling Stone. He is in it for the money more than Pearl Jam ever were, given what I know about his background. But he wanted to play it both ways. He wanted to play it that he had authenticity, and yet he wanted people to buy his records.
Do you think that it was a little bit of Kurt's inner conflict being externalized, playing out in between, you know, a conflict between him and this other side of the musical coin?
Well, absolutely. And what's important to remember is that Kurt's comments towards Eddie Vedder were said towards 50 acts at the time. Kurt loved to criticize other people and talk about them, and he was always trying to set himself up in contrast to people. But for some reason, because they were both from Seattle, Kurt's comments towards Eddie Vedder stung in a way that his comments about Axl Rose didn't sting.
And is this something that was confined to the kind of chattering classes, or did fans form camps too?
Fans formed camps, but fans didn't go out and say, I'm buying Nevermind, and because I bought this album, I can't buy Pearl Jam's record. You know, it wasn't Coke versus Pepsi. Music does not operate that way in terms of taste. What I find interesting about this sort of dynamic in Seattle is that its roots are actually much, much deeper in rock and roll. The roots go back essentially to the early 60s in England, and they go to the Beatles versus the Rolling Stones. And that's really where all this began. And it began simply for one reason, because a magazine called Melody Maker, which used to just cover live concerts and kind of the business, began to write about popular personalities, and they needed press. The Rolling Stones had this brilliant manager, Andrew Loog Oldham, and he was the guy that essentially created this whole concept of rock rivalry.
Oh, wow. He invented the paradigm?
He did. And the reason he did is that his band, the Rolling Stones, were not selling as much as the Beatles. And how do you make your band seem like a big deal? You say the Beatles are jealous of the Rolling Stones. The Rolling Stones are, quote unquote, the term he used to the Melody Maker was that the Rolling Stones were more authentic than the Beatles. And that began this Beatles versus the Rolling Stones dynamic in England. This blew up and it continued on. And in some ways, that's what we have in rock today.
So what do we know about how Pearl Jam and Nirvana actually felt about each other? Do we have any real evidence to kind of lean back on?
Well, we do. We have a lot of evidence. What we know is that they toured together and that they hung together and that these musicians knew each other and that privately Kurt and Eddie had a relationship, whether it's a friendship, might be stretching it. Eddie calls it a friendship or said that it was. After Kurt died, Eddie didn't talk about it for a while, but within a week after Kurt dying, Eddie appeared on Saturday Night Live.
This past weekend, and at the end of the show, while cast members and band mingled on stage, singer Eddie Vedder opened his shirt to reveal the letter K drawn on his T-shirt over his heart, a quiet salute to departed Nirvana frontman Kurt Cobain. Pearl Jam wound up its latest...
And it was one of the most sweetest things I think I've ever seen in terms of a way to sort of emphasize I'm thinking about him, but without putting it on Twitter or without making a big controversy. And despite all this controversy that happened and the things that were said in interviews, there was one moment at an MTV event where Kurt and Eddie were in the same room. And at one point, Kurt and Eddie grabbed each other and actually slow danced together. And this image, which was described to me by a number of people who were there, is one of the sweetest memories I can think of anything in Seattle music. This controversy has already happened. They've already kind of gone off on their own separate routes. But they both are prisoners to fame. They both can't escape what's been created. And in this moment, they are together dancing and embracing. And it is a softness that you would never hear in the press.
And that makes me think about, you know, these guys had so much in common, right? And they had been through, in a lot of ways, you know, great success, but it's an ordeal. And obviously, Kurt especially struggled with it. They must have had a lot of things to, you know, way more in common than they would have had sort of against one another.
Oh, absolutely. They both had stalkers. They both had drug issues over the course of their lives. They both had troubled relationships with parents, and both wanted to be famous, but when both became famous, it was beyond their control.
What do you think about the idea of rivalries between artists?
Well, I think rivalries always are going to exist. There are personal animosities that exist within rock music. Nowadays, if Kanye West has one line that even hints at Taylor Swift, that is immediately, within 12 seconds of it being released, being debated by people on the internet. So I do think the modern times are made for rivalries. Is that a good thing in our society? No, it is not, because it takes the tension away from music and from the power of music itself. The best music, whether it's hip-hop, whether it's Nirvana, whether it's Pearl Jam, has the capacity to change the way you feel about yourself. So in the end, I think you can go away and you can love the lyrics to Smells Like Teen Spirit, and you can relate to those. But you can also go to a Pearl Jam song like Daughter, and you can listen to those lyrics, and you can relate to those as well. You've got to have a Saturday night album, and you've got to have a Sunday morning coming down album as well. And there are places for all of that within somebody's large love of music.
Charles R. Cross contains multitudes. He's a music writer here in Seattle, and he's written books about Jimi Hendrix, Led Zeppelin, Bruce Springsteen, and a bunch of books about Kurt Cobain and Nirvana. Thanks a lot, Charles.
Thank you.
You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today on the show, it's all about the music. And, you know, this has become kind of an annual tradition for us here at Sound Effect, going back and revisiting stories involving music around this time of year, around the holidays, Thanksgiving. And speaking of traditions, we're going to head to St. Mark's Episcopal Cathedral in Seattle, where a special service happens every Sunday night that brings an eclectic group of people together. The elderly, families with kids, hipsters, the homeless. You can find all of these faces on Sunday night inside the cathedral's towering sanctuary. And they're all here to get lost in the voices of the Compline Choir. Sound Effect's Gabriel Spitzer stopped by to catch this religious service carried out in song that's been happening every Sunday night for more than five decades.
Bring out your joy, inhabitants of Zion.
I'm Jason Anderson, and I am the director of the Compline Choir at St. Mark's Cathedral in Seattle.
What does Compline Choir mean?
Compline Choir is actually named after the office that we chant. So Compline is the last prayer service that a monk or a nun would have prayed. And so the choir takes its name from the very office we chant.
What kind of people come to hear the Compline Choir?
Very diverse, from staunch believers to non-believers, to persons of other faith who are looking for some sort of spiritual yet not terribly religious experience. You'll also see folks who sit in the pew like good churchgoers would like to do, and folks who bring their blankets and pillows and want to just go and chill out in a corner and unplug from the world for 30 minutes and enjoy beautiful music in a beautiful space. Compline is sort of the gateway service for a lot of people. If you were to ask any number of folks who worship here on Sunday mornings, their first experience of St. Mark's, probably more than 85% of them would say through Compline.
According to thy word.
How did you first get involved with it?
That's a curious thing. Not to sing originally. I joined the group as part of my dissertation research into the life and music of Peter Hawick, who founded the group.
What is interesting about Peter's life and work that made him the subject of your doctoral thesis?
Well, there's a way that Peter intuits text through his music that makes the text stick in my brain. And what originally I wanted to do was just write a catalog of Peter's music, because no one had ever cataloged all of his works. I sent him an email at the time, and we had a three-martini lunch together, and we concluded with him saying, I think this project might become a little bit larger than you're imagining right now.
What's an insight that you gained about him that gave you a little bit of sense of where that power comes from?
Strangely enough, he never considered himself a composer. For him, the music was already inherent in the text. He compared it to an iconographer who already sees a work and is copying it in exact form. And in his case, he had already heard the music through the text, and so it was already there, according to him, and he was just writing it out. But second to that, he always said that he never actually remembered the process of composing. And so he would see his handwriting on the page and recognize it as his own, but would not remember the process of composing it. I could try to pin him down on that. Well, what would you call that in terms of the creative process? He said, well, I just feel like I probably enter a sort of secondary consciousness. This mystical description of how he was working and functioning, and it was also how I kind of received his music.
Do you feel like you enter that secondary consciousness when you're listening?
As a listener, it's easier to kind of be transported, at least for a brief moment, to something other than this world. A glimpse of the divine.
Anything that's been going on every week for half of a century must just become a thing that you experience with whatever you're experiencing along with your life. You're here on good weeks, and you're here on hard weeks, and you're here on weeks of joy, and here on weeks of sadness. And can you talk about some of the experiences being with Compline Choir, with whatever was going on in the world or in your life?
Right. So we've done some rather remarkable Compline services here. The most memorable for me, of course, was the day that Peter died. He died on a Sunday afternoon, about 4 o'clock, and I had to be here for rehearsal at 7:30, and that was really tough. But being together as a community, as a choir, and singing all of his music, all of the music in that service was by him, was just incredibly poignant.
What does it feel like when the singing is just what it's supposed to be?
So I very much consider what I do sort of a musical offering to the wider community, to the choir as an entity. And it's just for me, when everything comes together and goes off without a hitch and every note is just right, it's a moment of heaven on earth. And I don't know what heaven is anyway, but I know that I'm incredibly satisfied is an inadequate word. It just is something that just fills me up.
Jason Anderson is director of the Compline Choir at St. Mark's Cathedral in Seattle. They perform every Sunday night at 9:30, and it's always free and open to the public.
Let us bless the Lord.
Thanks be to
That story from Sound Effects' Gabriel Spitzer.
And merciful Lord, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, bless and preserve us.
Amen.
Okay, it'd be probably good for me to hear everyone check their vocal mic, please.
This is Sound Effect on KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and to close out our music show today, we revisit the episode No Regrets.
Check, check, check. Hey, 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 hey. Here I am.
Hello. Hi. 1, 2, check.
Seattle indie rock band Chastity Belt has no regrets. Or should I say, no regrets. That's the name of their 2013 debut album.
Mic check. Hello. Hello, hello.
Oh, okay, good.
Check, check, check.
Julia Shapiro, Lydia Lund, Annie Truscott and Gretchen Grimm joined Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad in the KNKX Performance Studio, and they explained to him why they stand behind the intentionally misspelled tattoo that was the album's namesake, and they played a little music, too.
For those who might not know you all that well, how'd you guys get to know each other, and how'd you guys become a band?
We met in college. We all went to Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington, and we were all friends before the band. The band started as a joke. Lydia and I came up with the band name, Chastity Belt, when we were wasted one night at a frat party. And then it kind of just stuck, and we would start chants, Chastity Belt chants, at shows after the other bands had played. It was kind of like our punk alter ego. Yeah. We would break bottles and then sweep them up because we felt bad.
So what were the early days of Chastity Belt like after that?
We played this one show. It was like the battle of the bands at this, again, a frat party.
Yeah, Beta Fest.
And we had one song, and it was really long and ridiculous. And then we had a break for the summer, and we came back, and Julia had written like a few songs, and we switched up instruments a little bit and actually started practicing.
Yeah, we sounded really bad, but I'd never played in a band before, so I thought that
one
we sounded
had,
good.
Yeah, it sounded good to me.
It sounded great to me, too.
And then we won Battle of Bands, and that pretty much just elevated us to where we are now, thanks to Beta Fest Battle of Bands.
Yeah. I'd always wanted to be in a band, but it was kind of intimidating.
Yeah.
So starting as a joke made it easier.
Your most recent release is called Time to Go Home, but previously you had a release called Regrets, intentionally spelled wrong.
Yeah.
Is there anything behind the title to that?
That's a tattoo that I have. Yeah. So we just kind of named it after that.
Too.
Yeah, Julia had the idea to get that tattoo for like a couple years, and I kept being like, absolutely do not do that. That's the worst idea I've ever heard. And then she did it, and I love that tattoo.
Yeah.
So
it's good.
Maybe best decision she's ever made.
So I've interviewed a handful of musicians that have looked back on some of their earlier music and said, I can't believe I sang those lyrics. What was I thinking? How did I feel that way back then? Do you have any songs or lyrics that you look back on that you sang before? You're like, what was going on?
Definitely. I wouldn't say that I regret singing it, but I would like to never sing it again. The song Goddamn, which is just like so, like, cutesy. I don't think it's that bad, but I just would rather not sing it anymore.
Is it just the cutesy factor, or is there anything else?
Yeah, just kind of embarrassing to sing.
How come?
I don't know. It's just, like, about, like, thinking a guy is hot, which is funny. Like, I still think it's funny, but I'm just like, I have other things I'd like to sing about.
I don't feel regret that much, but the one time I felt intense regret was, like, when I was feeling really angsty my senior year of college.
Totally.
I studied math, and I was just so done with it, and I was like, this sucks, I'm bored, and I just wish I would have been an art major. I regretted being a math major so much in that one moment.
I took one harp lesson in sixth grade, and I really wish I'd stuck with it. I wish that I could play
the harp. Me too. I would love for you to serenade me on the harp.
I kind of wish that I stuck with piano, because I took some piano lessons when I was 9.
I kind of feel like no regrets is a pretty good motto for our band in general.
Yeah.
Like, or life. No expectations, no regrets.
Yeah.
It's like we're all just like growing up a little bit, getting wiser and older and
no regrets.
Well, Julia Shapiro, Lydia Lund, Annie Truscott, and Gretchen Grimm, the members of Chastity Belt, thank you so much for being here. Can you take us out with a song?
Yeah, thanks for having us. We're going to play Caught in a Lie, which is a new song. You can find it on our next album, probably coming out in 2017 or at a live show.
Band Chastity Belt talking with sound effect producer Kevin Kniestad. You can see a video of them performing two of their songs, including one exclusive unreleased track, on our Facebook page. Just go to Facebook and search for KNKX Sound Effect. And since we had them in the studio, we figured we might as well put them to work. So take it away.
Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Ali Ferguson. The show had help this week from Lowell Kiesau, Gabriel Spitzer, and John Kessler.
Sound Effect's executive producer is Aaron Hennessy, with web help from Dave Nagaris.
You can download the Sound Effect podcast on iTunes and follow Sound Effect on Facebook.
Be sure to tune in next week when our theme is Call of Duty.
I just feel like that we can take every mess and we can make it and turn it into something good. And it just helps me help someone else down the road.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.